it's something that I was told very early on, that everything else you can be frugal, your accountant and your lawyer get the best.
My first transaction, the first $2 million that I raised, I didn't have a lawyer. And you're raising $2 million, you can't afford Archana back then. So what do you do, right?
And now it's refreshing to see founders who tell us whatever's in the best interest of the company, that should be the way the clause should work. It's shifting from, what if I leave, what if this happens, what if I steal a spoon? I mean, it sounds illogical. My own client has said that.
What is it that a person who's running a company needs to know about a term sheet from an investor?
Why can't all the lawyers come together in the room and create a temple?
Who are the founders you have seen who really kind of know how to make a deal happen really well? And
check.
Ready?
Okay.
Anup and Archana, welcome to the Barbershop. I know this has been like kind of pending for a long time, but thank you so much for taking the time. And for our viewers today, my personal experience with Archana has been that she's an incredibly founder first, client first, outcome first lawyer when it comes to the very specific field of raising capital for startups and early stage companies. She's helped us and she's helped so many people. Anup also is a beneficiary of her services. She runs River Law, earlier Rajaram Legal, which is one of the top legal firms for advising startups and also investors as well. But today, for all the people who are watching, and it's something that I was told very early on, that everything else, you can be frugal, your accountant and your lawyer get the best. And I think it's been really good advice. Anup and I are going to use this episode of The Barbershop to actually go deep in understanding legal elements of raising capital and everything else for founders. We both have very different worldviews. We've had different kind of investors, different kind of fundraising experiences. But I think the one thing we have in common is Archana.
Yes.
So I have a founder friend to kind of go deep with you on. And thank you so much for taking the time. So first things first, when it comes to a term sheet, what is it that a person who's running a company needs to know about a term sheet from an investor?
Great.
What is a term sheet and what are the things that you need to know about it?
So it's actually moved a lot. Once, like I think 8 years ago, you'd have 8 to 9 page of term sheets, right? Which has everything covered there.
Yeah.
But now it's barely a page or two. It has the valuation, the cap table, and everything. There's just one line that says the definitive, the long form agreements will have all customary terms.
Okay.
And the reason is why investors want the exclusivity, right? You don't have months to negotiate or even weeks. You have 2 days. And when it's a competitive founder, there's usually multiple folks circling in. So you'd largely just see valuation. And that's what a founder is looking for largely at that point. You see things like customary. Customary means, it's such an innocuous word, that's going to have the usual terms. And there's really not much to negotiate in a term sheet. The only thing that's covered there is the controversial reverse vest, which is frustrating for a founder.
What is that?
Right, where when you give ESOPs, there's vesting because there was options that vest. But you're a founder, you own 100% of the equity.
Correct.
And then investors have realized when you're betting on young startups, a founder may not be there. It's not a promoter-run company for 20 years. It's not the PE formula. They're coming into a company that's 20 years old and you're investing at a different stage. This is a young company. So you have to earn your equity, right? Because it's a new company. Sometimes the company is not even in existence. You're evaluating a founder while they're when they're in the process of actually setting this company up or they're ideating. So when it's a group of 3 founders, reverse vest, or if it's a 2-year-old company, that's one clause that's spelled out, that there's X percent that you've earned for the amount of time you've put in, and then an amount of shares that will vest over a period of time. And the biggest learning, unlearning has always been that one clause, right? When it's founders, rightly so, you're taking very low salary. Often people like you have said, I don't really need salary because that's how passionate you are about the company. Everything is in the company, and there are clauses that say if you are let go, or if you leave, you lose all your shares, which is a very, very problematic clause for a founder, that how can investors come together and throw me out of my own company? So everyone gets...
Yeah, but isn't it fair?
Yes. So this is the mistake with when you have a group of 3 founders, when each one says, but I can't think long term. What if I have to resign? And then even if you resign in 2 years, you're leaving with 50% of your shares, and the continuing founders
build that out.
Going to have to build that company. So that maturity amongst younger co-founders now is starting to change. Earlier, there was a lot of over-engineering. Even if it's for fraud, like termination for cause, it's given all the governance issues today. Obviously, you'd want to have draconian clauses. It's meant to be, it's supposed to sound crazy so that you don't think in that direction. That as a founder, you're here to run a company. You're not going to actually commit any of it. So that's why your shares are on the hook. The company will tank. But there is a lot of over-engineering on that, and it's a bad signaling issue also. It is controversial. Of course, everyone understands that those are your shares. No one wants to take it, right? These are investors. They're not looking at running your company. So to think through it, and now it's refreshing to see founders who tell us whatever's in the best interest of the company, that should be the way the clause should work. It's shifting from what if I leave, what if this happens, what if I steal a spoon? I mean, it sounds illogical. My own client has said that sometimes, and it's like, why wouldn't an investor care? So I feel like sometimes maybe founders haven't got the right advice in the past, or they've been spooked that their shares can be taken away. So even though that clause is sometimes spelled out, or that they own zero and they have to earn their own shares, I think for some founders, it just throws them off that why will they have to earn their shares? Yeah. It's their company. Yeah. So, but that is critical, especially when you're a group of three founders. You have to have that hard conversation. Yeah. What if one of you gets cold feet in year three even, or year five? You know the journey of a company. Yeah. You know the journey in 9 years. What else is left to go? Yeah. So you can't just say, I walk with my shares after 2-3 years. And that's a tough one. And I know saying this is problematic because when we are company counsel and you're negotiating, you want a fair package because it's ultimately how it's triggered, who triggers. You're solving for a strategic. A strategic, they're investing in you, but ultimately different mindset than a VC. So it's not that much of a one-size-fits-all, but that's the one clause that jumps out in a term sheet where investors know you can't just say completely silent. There is some amount of language there that talks about how much is free, how much will, is it monthly, quarterly, a lot of that. If you're emphasizing on that on a seed stage deal, that itself is, so it's a very nuanced issue that it's not just legal. It's what you're sending out when you're negotiating things like, if I commit fraud, what's the standard for fraud? Fraud is just fraud. Yeah. And if you're bringing that up, that's a very scary thing to negotiate.
I agree. So there's valuation. Then there is reverse vesting. What's your, my position on reverse vesting is that you have to, like earlier I used to think, hey, it's my company, my equity will never vest. Yeah. And then someone's like, hey, but what if you decide to leave in a year, year and a half? Then everyone's sitting, like you've put the company at serious risk. So I'm like, yeah, that's fair. If I'm going to hang around, it's going to vest. So then it has to be like unconditional vesting. It's not, there should be no other
condition on it, right? Right, yeah.
So there's reverse vesting. Then there is, there's stuff like liquidation preference and anti-dilution.
Right.
So what are those two? I think those are the two ones which also like a lot of founders, like they sound like complicated words.
Right. And yeah, liquidation, it's that word. And it sounds also misleading, right? If the company is going into liquidation. So that's just, it's like a guaranteed capital protection for an investor, but it's typically 1x. And again, the industry sees different churn. So currently it just means that if investors putting in like a 3 million Series A round, that no matter what happens, the investor gets 1x, they get their 3 million back or their pro rata participation. So they own 20%, whichever is higher. So again, that just means that if the company drastically underperforms, the investor is just getting 1x even 6 years down the line, right? It's not like but you do see some term sheets which will say 25% IRR or a 1.5x. Or if the company does a fundraise at a certain price, then the 1.5x falls away. But all that sets a really bad precedent going forward, right? A 1.5x, maybe when you're thinking seed series, it's not too terrible because you're thinking long-term growth. But as you raise more capital, as soon as an investor coming in has seen a 1.5x, they're all going to ask for it.
Yeah.
And the VC takes as much of a hit because you've put in 3 million, now the company is doing well and is raising a 100 million check, and a 100 million check asking for 1.5 is going to eat into your kitty.
Correct.
So a lot of VCs have realized that and no one really asked for it, but we're starting to see some term sheets which actually do have an IRR in the liquidation preference, which is very difficult. And it's actually that VC will also take that hit if anyone else asks for it, not just the founder.
So on LiquPref, right, the way to, so if an investor has put 3 million at, let's say, a 20%, that means the company is worth 15 million post money, and they have a 20% stake. If the company is sold for 10 million, then ideally they should get back only 2 million because they own 20% of a 10 million asset. But if there is liquidation preference, that means they will still take out 3 million, which is 30% of the company. So they will get a larger share of the liquidation.
Right, but if the founders own majority, then the founders get the balance. It's not like the investors.
Yes, of course.
Right,
they get everything. More percentage because of that. So that's that's LickPref. On LickPref, you're saying 1.25x or IRR math, etc. I agree with you. Fundamentally, I think it incentivizes founders for the next valuation. I think that's what I don't like. When someone tells me, I want this and this, I'm like, what's equity risk?
Yes.
It's an equity risk. You bake in the risk, you put that in the value, and that's pretty much it. Beyond that, now don't make me run after valuation, because you're probably incentivizing a whole host of wrong behaviors also.
Right.
That's why you should do that.
It sounds like you're overpaying, so you're trying to hedge by saying,
correct,
if it doesn't happen, then I need to prepay this, because ideally I would have won. So we've seen that also with growth investors coming and asking, what was the legacy? Why was it even there? Because it's not a standard term.
Correct.
It's not like that's what it normally is, and then you're correcting it to a 1x. So it's usually a lot of clauses, even if commercially are sort of okay with, it's the optics of this. And once it's in the agreement, then negotiating it out for later investors, because it's always, right, earlier high risk, but later stage, it's why would you?
And what about stacks of preference? Like VC1 will say, I want a higher, preference compared to, let's say, ESOPs and founder equity. Then the next one will say, hey, I'm coming at a higher valuation, my check size is bigger, so I want a higher. The next guy will say, I want a higher. Please come on.
The other way, think about it, Archana, why can't all the lawyers come together in the room and create a temple?
You don't think we haven't tried? Tried. And it was ironically
seed, for a seed round, you've got this term sheet. For a late stage private equity, you've got this term sheet, so that everybody knows that this is the standard terms and conditions.
We'll all go bankrupt
now,
one.
I think Axel has a really good seed stage term sheet. Like, I think Axel has a really good
one. But everybody would have a different have gotten,
one, right? I mean,
it's fairly standardized. They look the same and it'll say customary terms
customary terms. That's between the lines is where the...
Anything could happen. But I think more than lawyers, right, VCs, because of the volume that you're doing this, you can't have every clause up for negotiation, and they wanted to standardize it. And I think this is on everyone's mind that we should. The US has standardized docs, the NVCA standard, with great footnotes that even tell you how much you can negotiate. But most things are off the table for discussion because it's that set in stone. So a deal gets signed very quickly. But in India, because you see so many issues coming up, right, when each fund has a different set of portfolios, different issues, you can't standardize it across the board because each one will have certain pain points, and then you can't go in with a very negotiated position because then the company council will also have to demonstrate value, right? Even if it's a fair draft. Thankfully, I've told Anup sometimes, there's really nothing for me to add in this. And we had an honest conversation because, I mean, we did that round in Series E, and then I said I could be a painful lawyer and try to change all of this, but it's going to antagonize these investors. It's actually a fair draft.
Good
and it
draft,
I still sometimes get worried saying it to my own client that it's actually a great draft. We don't really have to do much, but it is appreciated by both sides, even with the investors when we've advised them coming in late. But I digress so much. I forgot what we were even talking about.
No, liquidity preference.
The stacks of it that, again, investors have realized that if they come in, and let's say they've just said they should be superior, they will always be higher than equity. So it's always investors, and then ESOPs
equity.
Founders are in the same pool, right? But if they say they want to be superior to angels because angels came in, it's a friends and family, they're almost equity. And if they say they want to be senior to them, again, they're setting the stage for the next guy to do it, and they will always be subordinate. So most investors, 9 out of 10 times, it's just the word pari passu, just saying we're equal.
Yeah.
They don't usually ask for senior LP. When it's not a VC that's invested frequently in India, sometimes they're used to it. Like, in the US, sometimes you do get superior LP, and then some of these funds have asked for it, but there's just very heavy pushback. At least the VCs that we've seen investing in India don't agree to it, because then that's just going to keep happening. They'll go lower and lower in the chain, right? So, and it does make a huge difference. In a way, even if you say pari passu LP, whoever's coming in at the highest valuation, in that very example that you gave, when you decide to take capital out, in that example, when you take 3 million off the table, 10 million is no longer there, right, for pro rata.
Yeah.
So when you participate, it's always on what's left after you return capital. So in a way, whoever's paid the highest valuation actually has, it says pari passu, but in a way, senior LP if the company underperforms. So you came in at great, like a 1 billion valuation, and the company then underperforms and goes very low, you're going to take whatever's off the table.
Yeah.
And then it keeps reducing. And in fact, it's a most simple clause in an agreement. But any lawyer who's had to sit through the Excel, and when it becomes a suboptimal exit, who takes out capital, who participates pro rata, and then if an investor is invested from series A to D, then that Series D will participate by taking out capital, but A will participate pro rata. Yeah. It's a very complicated exit.
You're right.
And lawyers are not the best at math. But actually, reading that, like going through the Excel, seeing all the different permutations and combinations is what really helps you understand how complex it is. And a lot of companies realized that they needed to have an illustration annexed to the SHA to really set out what happens at different valuations. Because you have 15 investors and no one wants to go into a dispute when an exit happens. Because it could still be a great exit for someone who came in early on, but not for the Series E investors. So best to have an illustration.
Tell me a little bit about how you've seen, like you've been in the industry now for
20 years. Yeah.
And you've been doing this kind of work for 20 years?
Yes. Just
how have you seen it evolve, like from 2005, 6, 7 seed or Series A deals?
So there was no. So in 2006, when I started out at Nishit Desai, there was just late stage private equity. I didn't even hear the word Series A and B back then. I know there was some of their clients, like back in the days, Silicon Valley Bank, there were some early stage investments, but it was largely private equity. So it was a lot of transaction work, promoter driven companies. Same with AZB as well. I think I started getting some exposure, and the first company was Lenskart back in 2012 when Ronnie Skruvala's family office was doing the Series B round. I found it fascinating that what is a Series A and B, and very young founder, the company was just barely 2 to 3 years old, and it was a very different beast altogether. So then, and back then there were all sorts of different terms. There was 2x LP back then, there was superior LP, 2x, like, or they had something called a participating liquidation preference where you take your capital. In that example, you'll take the 3 million out and you'll come back to participate pro rata. Because the idea of,
that's crazy, you know?
Yeah. Because it was earlier the idea of, I just have a business plan.
Nobody knew about it, right? I mean, it just seems like one clause to it, right? I mean, it's okay, innocuous, you move on. And then suddenly, you're like, shit, man, you paid so much.
That 3 million is almost like principal on debt then.
Yes. Absolutely. So it's like a better deal than debt. And there was
something like the company buyback or the founder buyback.
And adding founder clauses on the founder to give an exit personally. Yeah. So that's a lot in the Indian context, that the founder is just found in the company is one. Everything else is shareholders different from the company. But when it comes to the founder, it's like, no, the founder, you are the company. We're backing you. And that's all well.
You're not very far from the truth also. It's not far from the truth. But I get where it becomes onerous a little bit.
Right, because suddenly you have 1,000-employee company, you have 5 different subsidiaries. How is one person going to be fully liable for everything and on the hook for every single thing? And where do you have the liquidity to be on the hook for everything? If you had it, you wouldn't have raised capital, right?
Correct. So, 2012 was Lenskart, where things were like kind of still, there was
still
no standardization.
No standardization, and people had 100-page agreements because people were just using the PE formula. These are all the terms. Investors understood, different risks. So then they started adding. So it was like a hybrid between 2012, 2015. It was still fairly investor friendly company council. There weren't too many players. People had a very tight budget. And this learning of get a good counsel, I think founders were more excited back then that it's so easy to get funded. Yeah, you just have a business plan. I can get 2 million. I think there was more excitement back then. And at least being on the other side of it, right, as when I'd moved in-house and seeing all of it, there was often no counsel and the founder is just doing his best to figure out. It was more conversational. Yeah. So there wasn't really much negotiation and it did get done faster. And then you start getting burned is a bit of an extreme word, but you just see some bad incidents happen. Yeah. And then you start understanding what can go wrong, who has leverage, what can be enforced. And then founders started talking to each other and then they do recognize that having counsel can help. Why is it taking so long? Why is it a 150-page agreement for a 2 million round, right? Why do we have so many clauses on? And that's the reason why it actually even started out that we were having like 3 pages on an IPO clause on a company that was incorporated 6 months ago. It was just so much of reading to
That's
do.
Bizarre.
It was just bizarre. No one wanted to cut it short. That was just the precedent. So you just keep it like that.
And was that the trigger for you to start Rajaram Legal?
That was because when a family office is investing without LPs, it was great. I had a lot of flexibility to just rewrite the template. So it became a 35-page SHA, because I was leading a lot of it. Right? I wanted to make my life easy and realize that by the time a company is in D and E, someone else will add that clause. For now, we can just say do it with consent. And then that's all you need, right? If you need investor consent, why do you need 10 other clauses on how you'll engage the banker, what is the floor price for the IPO, and it's just so and that price will get negotiated in each round. It just made no sense. So there was a huge market for it, and no one wanted to go near VC back then because it didn't really have much of a budget. And it felt like it's a lot of hours because you have to do diligence and you have to do documentation. But what diligence on a three-year-old company?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's even pre-revenue and there's really not much. There's seven employees, so it's more like a check the box that their cap table is clean, they have their basic compliances in check. Many of them are not even regulated, right? Like a D2C company is much easier to diligence than something like fintech or any regular, if it's SEBI or RBI related, and you don't see that many other than fintech companies. So it just felt like an easier, exciting way to do it versus not getting stuck in these long agreements. Sometimes you don't have the option if that's the base draft you're dealing with, right? If you're coming in for a different investor. But it just felt like there's so many clauses there that just weren't needed and overwhelming for a founder, where a founder felt like, oh, I do need a lawyer because who's going to read those 150 pages?
Yeah, that is true. That is true. And also, I think over a period of time, it's very hard to standardize this stuff. I think that it's every company situation is so different and so specific. And
what's happening in the industry will also be reflective of...
Also, demand supply. Like a lot of these deals are demand supply, not necessarily the deal on the table, but what's happening in the market around it also, right?
Yes.
What have you kind of learned as you built out? So what are the first deal you did as RL?
Actually, it was, and I had to create this email ID overnight. This is when I wasn't even sure, it was more aspirational having my own firm, but then it was, how do I do this? And the first deal was actually because I was temporarily Z47's general counsel as well.
At that time, why is everyone rebranding? Why is SAF becoming Elevation? What Peak 15, Z47?
Yes. And that's why at least Rajram Legal and RL, so at least I don't get caught up with the different name. I still say RL.
I'm surprised you're like not RL, like whatever, 95 or whatever.
So one of their companies, and actually Daily Hunt was doing they had to do a round in about 6 days' time. That was a flat time period because Franklin Templeton was on their cap table and they were going to, you know, wind up and do an in-specie. Okay, that word sounds crazy. Yeah. In-specie distribution is just when they're shutting down and they're going to distribute shares to like 900 shareholders potentially. So Daily Hunt shares, they had like a five-day ticking clock. And if they didn't close the round, that's it. And you will suddenly become a public. It's just going to become a nightmare to suddenly have 900 additional shareholders on the cap table.
That's crazy.
And it's
you were at Z47 at the time.
Yes. And with Ronnie, I was just doing multiple things. And then this was they asked me if I could do this and it needed someone on it 24/7. And it sounded impossible to me. There was a term sheet. And in India, it's 5 to 7 days is just not possible. But it seemed challenging. I didn't even know what to call the firm. I didn't have a firm. And I just thought, okay, Rajaram Legal, that's just something. And it was within 24 hours, had an email ID up and running. And that deal did get done in 7 days. And
really?
It was crazy because you're negotiating with a strategic ByteDance.
So what is happening there? What, like, for the audience who might not know the full context of this?
Right. So Daily Hunt aggregate, like a platform. Yeah. Like Daily Hunt had... multiple investors from Z47, Omidyar Network, bunch of VCs, and also a bit of the growth stage funds as well, Falcon Edge up to a certain point, and then Franklin Templeton as well. And then had to make sure that they find an investor to buy out Franklin Templeton in 5 days or less, because that was the cutoff date for Franklin Templeton to do this distribution to their own shareholders. They either needed the cash, which they'll distribute, all the shares of the company will be distributed.
And was price discovery done?
Yes. So then this is the founder at the back, Viru, just making sure that they were in conversations. But now this had to suddenly become accelerated, where this thing about it being this tight suddenly happened in a span of, I think this was back in 2016.
Yeah.
I think it was October 2016. And then first negotiating with the strategic, no one slept, I think, for those 7 days. It was 2 to 3 days that you had to first generate the first draft, send it across, and it was like also making the bare minimum changes, but it's a strategic. So you have to also solve for making sure that the strategic can't block anything. How do the other investors handle it? And you have to then finalize it and then in parallel be on standby to speak to each investor, their internal legal teams, what have we changed? And no one is actually going to come back, right? And you can't send a draft and then chase an investor within a few hours, but everyone understood the gravity of the situation. It has been actually one of the most exciting deals in my entire life, from a timeline perspective, the issues that we had to solve for, and actually achieving.
Daily Hunt was large. In 2016, it was already a sizable company, right?
Yes, it was a large strategic Series D investment. And that was our
and
first.
And was it just
deal.
A pure secondary? You did a primary also in
primary that. And a secondary.
Really?
Yes, it was.
All in 7 days?
Yes, all in 7 days. You have to generate drafts.
This is very important, Archana. You should let people know then this is just one off. A lot of people time, you know, people come and say, hey, you know what, this guy got the entire fundraise in 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work, dude. That's not the market standard.
It really doesn't.
A lot of people will have some unreasonable expectation.
Even 4 weeks is like, must have taken a lot.
Of course, it can't be, right?
Because when you have that many investors, yeah, and each one will have a point of view, each one will have comments. And each time you incorporate it, you have to sensitize more people. So, and then you can't be too adversarial, saying we're not going to take any of those comments. Yeah. But I don't even know how we achieved it. It was really, it was like a bonding experience back then with Viru, that I don't think anyone slept. For me, it took a while just to figure out all the different accents on the call. Just, it's like, what happened? But it was really, really, I remember so many aspects of it. Like, it was just yesterday.
Wow. Yeah. And that's how RL started.
Yes, that's how, and that's what was such a, not even a creative name, it was just whatever domain, because how else to run this deal?
Yeah.
In fact, earlier in the year when I was toying with the idea of what should I do, I just did Lenskart Series E with my Unilaser email ID. That was the name of the family office.
But you were working with them, or you were not working?
So that was the great start to it, actually, because when I moved in-house, for working with someone like a Ronnie Screwvala, who had like multiple verticals popping up, almost every second week, it felt like there was something new. It started with family office investing. Yeah. Then there's Upgrad, right, with EdTech. And then there's U Sports, which had like the first Kabaddi League. Then he went into film production. So it was fascinating. So that this is it, the job for life. Every day there's something new. And then eventually there's a great legal team, and everyone was just running with it. No, I didn't really have much to do after points. I would just sit there thinking, what next? What next? And I would keep asking Ronnie, what else are you rolling out? He's like, there's a lot right now. Yeah. So that's it. And then I would keep asking, what next? So then I think more out of impatience, he just said, if you have that much time on your hands, why don't you just go advise other folks? And that's such a great way to have the ability to start out, right? I had the comfort of my GC position, but had the full freedom to advise other folks. Wow. So I was just toying with it. And then that's how I advised Lenskart, then was advising Z47, Matrix back then. They didn't care. And in fact, it was so, like, such good luck that Unilaser and Matrix, I mean, Z47, they were right opposite CJ House and this other building, that I could just be at both places at the same time. And then things just unfolded. Yeah, in Bombay.
Wow.
So it was a great lucky start where everything just sort of fell into place.
And then we met in 2017. So you were...
So I just set up. So when the Daily Hunt deal happened, that's what it meant to me, that, oh, wow, this is a great life. I love doing deals, and I'll just do 2-3 in a year where I go all in and just get it done very quickly. And then I'll still have my, you know, just general counsel position and high level be involved. And it's a great life. It's also demanding, but in spikes that I can handle, and I'll be a solo practitioner and I'll enjoy doing it. But after the Daily Hunt deal, the deals just took off. It just took a life of its own. And I didn't know where to go get people from. Like, who's going to... There's no firm. It's called Rajaram Legal. And, but yeah, just looking back, a lot of things just fell into place in a great way.
Wow.
And yeah, this is where
we met a year later, I think. And, and you met the Rahul and Sid because you were on Z47's side.
Yes. And again, there, because we were more for... I was just in the room initially as like Matrix's counsel when they were doing a round. I think they were doing a round from Bertelsmann, and interacted with them, and then became their counsel eventually when in their CDC round.
Yeah. You seem to have a habit of doing that.
Yeah. It's been a great formula. It's continuously worked.
Well, I think that's also like testament to what you've done. What about you? Like, I'm sure you have seen many lawyers, many firms. You have obviously like top investors who must be having different kinds of counsel. Like, what is your exposure to the legal world like? Of course, I frankly, like, because I've met Archana, and like she's 80% of my lawyer exposure, frankly, because she doesn't let me meet the others at all. So thank God, like thank God for that.
Yeah, I don't let. I wonder how many people have actually been there booing you, and then who all are your lawyers on this side? I should do some investigation.
Even people who represent our investors and all, I don't directly deal with them at all, because
the
few ones that do, Archana gets me in the room just for entertainment value. Look, Shantanu.
Yeah, we've had some entertaining ones.
But I like, for me, that she's the bar, and Prasad, who was a partner at Rajaram Legal, and Archana were like my window to the world. But you have obviously kind of experienced a lot more. So how would you kind of contrast lawyers in this space?
So Shantanu, it's a complicated one, to be honest. You know, when you're advising the client on the other side, you still let go of a few things, thinking about it, you know, these are all edge cases, maybe not work out, and then it's fine, right? And in a career about 25 years, we've dealt with probably about 20 plus law firms, did about whatever 100 plus transactions. My first transaction, the first $2 million that I raised, I didn't have a lawyer.
That's what you're saying, yeah.
And anything and everything that was to go wrong in that term sheet was there.
Really?
Everything, right?
Like, and what? Like, what did you agree to?
Insane. Like, if the investors tomorrow were to exit, the expenses for the transaction has to be borne by me. Can it be that if they do an IPO, if a company does an IPO, and whatever the bank is, typically it gets prorated, allocated between, you know, whatever shares you're selling versus what the company is doing. No, everything, with the lawyer fees, the banker's fees, simple thing like that. And I was like, okay, this is like probably standard, right? That's market practices. And you're raising $2 million. You can't afford Archana back then. So what do you do, right? Okay, whosoever is a friendly, like a lawyer who's mid-rung, you just take their services. And back in the day, we in fact had just one lawyer representing both the investors and the company. I mean, they did a fantastic job. No this about it. But there were too many things which were generally sent like it's one-sided.
Yeah.
And this is with me, you know, starting after 16, 17 years of investment banking career.
Yeah.
So imagine somebody who's starting his career at the age of 22, 23. Yeah. What is he going through? And these are, once it is drafted, for the life of you, the only conversation that would happen, but you agreed in the previous round, no?
Yeah.
Why are you changing it now? Last time you gave it, okay, let's stick to it this time, then next round we'll change it. And it never gets changed, right? Yeah. You're at it on the hook and constantly you're worrying, is it the right thing for the company? Is it the right thing for the founders or not? And this is where I think, you know, a lot of cleanup happened for us. So the last two rounds that we went through, there were a bunch of very, you know, big firms that came in and part of the process who were negotiating, you know, like literally heated conversation. But we held on to the position to say that, you know, now we need to do what is right for the company and we need to build this for a long period of time. But genuinely, I think it's a process that people, until as they don't realize, and a lot of times we'll say, okay, it doesn't matter, this will not happen and stuff like that. You may, at some point in time, if the company doesn't do well, big deal, you know, everybody takes a loss. But if the company does well, and at that point in time, you go back and, oh my goodness, you signed up on a lot of things, which either the promoter is on the hook, and it can be on the hook in a very, very negative way, where there could be some personal liabilities on you, God forbid something happened in the company, and suddenly somebody has taken away your entire share. Like, oh my goodness.
What happened to that?
So but that's the part where I feel like, I don't know how lawyers are still valued, because when things go well, and you'd be surprised, every SHA will still say this, all costs of an exit, thankfully borne by the company. But initially it starts off with, like I said, because everyone says founder and company are one, but less on the founder. But till now, at least 95% of the companies, it does say that the company will bear all costs of an exit, which is crazy, right? You have 9 investors.
Yeah.
And everyone will be in exit mode. Secondaries will keep happening. Yeah. And why would the company take the load of the banker fees, the legal fees? That's potentially crores of rupees being loaded on the company. It doesn't make sense, even from an investor standpoint. So we've asked that question time and again to an incoming investor, saying that, wouldn't you have a problem with this? There are 5 other guys who are in exit mode. We should take this out. But they all wanted to be there, but no one actually loads those costs, because the founder just says, you want a banker, there's the one banker EL. Yeah. But all the ones who want to sell will sell in proportion. Yeah. But there are some funds who don't want to load that cost, right? So then they do want the company to pick that up. So it does become very heated. Like in a full acquisition, we have seen it where the costs are loaded on the company and it's anyway deducted, right? Like the acquirer will have that complicated closing adjustments, like all payouts of the company will get factored and reduced from the purchase price. So it's like, what are you achieving if you're going to say that the company will bear it? And it's like, you're taking money out of your own pocket. You're getting paid less per share, but I guess it's just better than...
Yeah, actually, a lot of times, honestly, it's not even the investors who got to be blamed for it. I've had some of the best, you know, negotiation with my investors. I said, hey, wait a minute, I'm not even aware about it. It's actually the other side, with due respect, the law firm, who's trying to say, okay, let's just try it out. Maybe this works, right? Yeah. Maybe we'll get that extra thing for a client. Yeah. And sometimes you wonder, you know, you don't really need to do this, but and then if you push back, it'll all come back to, you know, what is right. But most of the times it will be, you start with a very high position and then you try and kind of keep negotiating and water it down. But it takes so much of time and effort for everyone to get to the right shape and form.
And I think a lot of deal making also comes down to ego and posturing.
Right? Yeah, so much.
That is what it is all about.
So much.
And you, like, who have you seen, like, I want to ask you two questions. Who are the founders you have seen who really kind of know how to make a deal happen really well, and you like you enjoy working with or learn from a lot, and who are the lawyers who you who are on opposite side of the table and you learn a lot from, like what are they are two separate questions.
Yeah, from the founder's side. Fair, actually.
And what do they do that like kind of like, cool, this is really good stuff? Because end of the day, they're running a business. So then they are negotiating with buyers and suppliers and distributors and everyone in the world, right? So I'm assuming there is a certain commercial muscle that they already have, which in this context...
I think I would first mention just Ronnie's name, Ronnie Skruvala, because yeah. I worked with Ronnie back in like 2010 during his UTV days, right? That's a promoter-driven company listed and then sold to Disney and got delisted. And that was just pure promoter mindset. And then the way he negotiated, right? Things that when you're doing an M&A deal, what is his employment agreement? It was very savvy. And early on to think of points even from the other person's side, like not just thinking in a silo, but what's actually something that even makes sense. And I saw that a lot as an investor as well. It's not just, it's there is a lot of sense to how and getting deals done. And Ronnie did a lot of acquisitions for UpGrad, and there were a lot of stock deals as well, right? It's very tough to negotiate a stock deal, and it was just done so well. How do you incentivize founders? It just felt like as a negotiator, it was just fantastic to see it. And I felt like in many ways, working with Ronnie was like working with a senior partner at a law firm. Yeah. Always question the red line. Like Ronnie was very closely involved with the process. Won't just let counsel run wild. Like if I marked up a document and it didn't make sense, like I knew I had to question everything I was doing, because it all comes back to how efficiently are you running a deal. So I would say Ronnie has always stood out as someone who knew how to strike a deal and get it done in record time. You can't just have an acquisition. Usually M&A is a different beast. It takes a long time, especially when you're an acquirer, to run a diligence, to run the documents. And I think they closed multiple deals in just one.
And what was it like? Was it clarity of thought? Was it
clarity of thought, knowing how to negotiate, not like posture for too long. And also, Ronnie's emails are also something else. Sometimes it's just... And he also knows he sounds like a different person on emails. It sounds more like aggressive than he is in person. Ah. So I think it's also very to the point. There's no too much of... Let's try our luck. Like a lot of times the feedback we get is also let's try and then drop it. But sometimes no one knows when to stop trying, right? And you antagonize the other side sometimes. So
yeah.
I would say Ronnie in the second, actually not just because Anup is in the room, but it is really refreshing when you tell a founder that, yeah, you could ask for this. And usually the immediate reaction is, yeah, let's try. Anup didn't want to try anything funny at all. It was very clear. We went through some of the clauses, how it does help a company in the long run, and yeah. just said, I don't want to optimize for these kind of things.
Wow. Hey, you're busy running the company, right? You might as well get the shit done and move on and build the business.
And he's asked me frankly, have you seen like a founder indemnity, right? Like why would a founder, like indemnity is the worst thing to give on paper when you think about it.
In layperson terms for everyone, yeah.
So if you're raising 100 million and things are great in the company, right? Your investors have done all the diligence possible. Nothing has come out. But ultimately, they want 20 pages from you that says you've paid all taxes, your finances are true and correct, you're on full compliance with law. But if anything goes wrong, so let's say they invest and you give them this list of 20 things, everything is great. And let's say there's a 15 crore tax claim, something that just got missed, or you didn't know GST was applicable, something comes up. It means the founder has to pay up and make good that loss for the investor because they didn't factor that outflow. And it's written in so many convoluted ways that if the investor suffers a loss, which itself is tough to prove, right? Like how do you know that that 15 crore outflow itself is a loss? So to get out of all that technical jargon, it just says that the founder will make good the company for all these kind of payouts. Because the way an investor is thinking about it is, you don't have to give those 20 statements. You can always qualify it. So if there are some issues, there are some, you know, liabilities not really accounted for, there's some cleanup, you can give even 40 pages, you can give 100 pages of disclosures. So all they want to know is, just tell us everything so we can factor it before going in. But if you're saying everything is fine, then that's not been factored in the price, or that's just an outflow, and that needs to be indemnified. It's for losses. But it's a scary concept when you're raising, even if you're raising 1 million, you can't say you'll indemnify.
Yeah.
And then the way to appease a founder is by saying, okay, you don't have to, we know you don't have the cash. You will be capped out to your shares in the company, but that's all he's sitting on. Yeah. So that's what he said, that you have to, if God forbid something goes wrong, all your shares are at stake because someone's going to invoke that indemnity. But again, this is, in the last 20 years, I've just not seen an indemnity being invoked. It's just investors take it ultimately to enforce it. Even if things have gone wrong. The counsel missed it in the diligence. It generally came up later. Sometimes you just get slapped by with notices, right? If you follow the letter of the law, but tough luck, RBI took a different view. Yeah. Whatever it may be, people want to actually problem solve because they want to see this business, they want to see this company list or be acquired. They're not going to antagonize the founder and say, take that 10 crore out of the company. So it just does not get enforced. But it's more like a deterrent again that if you have anything, if there's any dirt, disclose it because your shares are on the hook. So it creates that discipline in how the diligence is done. You're sharing all information. You're making sure you're actually disclosing and not withholding critical information. But does it get invoked? It really doesn't get invoked. So it's like telling a founder, I know on paper it sounds unfair because how can you be, you can hire the best lawyers and your legal advisors got it wrong. So why should the buck stop at you at every instance? And sometimes that's why agreements say you will hire a Big Four as your accountant, you'll hire a certain law firm to have all of these guardrails. But then why would you still give that indemnity? But it's one of those.
Anu was like, okay, screw it.
Ashanta, if you come to think about it, right? The ask is not unfair. Very, very, very little chance that the founder doesn't know what's happening in the company.
Yeah.
Right? And therefore, to hold yourself accountable to whatever the investor is asking for things that you are not disclosing at this point in time, and they later say, hey, you know, I was not aware about you, and therefore I'm not going to indemnify you.
Yeah.
It's unnecessary dragging the matter, right? And there is no reason why the investor should not get the protection for it. And I don't think so the investor community is going to be so unreasonable where something which is truly not known to the founder, they're going to penalize him for that particular thing, right? Because eventually, they also equally need us to run the company, to build his businesses.
Right.
And they know for a fact what amount of, you know, effort that we put in building the business. But something which is a governance issue, something which is like clear mismanagement of funds, you better be accountable for it.
Yeah, that is true. That is actually very, very true. And, you know, one of the things I actually wanted to like shift tracks a little bit to what we are seeing happening in India a lot, and I don't know what your views are with Mintify, but we're seeing a lot of IPOs happen, and
crazy,
right? And I think with the first wave, with, you know, Policy Bazaar, Zomato, Nykaa, this was in the heyday of liquidity of 2021. Then we saw a wave two happen, which was, you know, Swiggy and. But now, apparently, there are almost 38, 39 companies that are going to go IPO in the next 4 to 5 quarters.
Yeah.
$100 billion of market cap. Like, it's already $100 billion of market cap already. Yeah. That's $200 billion in a $5 trillion kind of public market. So, it's now becoming almost 4-5% of our...
Yes, it is. It is, absolutely. Yes.
Of our public markets. Yeah. What are you seeing? Like, are you seeing your clients, your, you know... Whether it's investors or companies, prepare for IPOs.
In fact, Anup said I should set up a capital markets team, and that Mintify could very much be the first client. But it is a completely different beast. There are like clients of ours are either preparing for IPO or have already IPO'd, like a 5-star business finance lending company. So,
and do you play a role in that as well? Like when
no, it's a completely different beast. And then we don't go into public markets. It's only the private equity or even the pre-IPO round. We've seen a lot of pre-IPO secondaries.
Correct.
What we have helped is investors prior to the IPO. A lot changes with the SHA when you step down from the board. So we have advised folks, like we advised SoftBank before Swiggy went for its own IPO, because there's a lot of nuance there with what's happening to all the docs, right? What continues till what stage of the filing. So that's different, but not for a company. It has been, it's one of those things, right? Like even earlier, we saw a lot of our own clients doing M&A, but we would just do it sparingly. We just wanted to focus on fundraise, which sounded crazy that we should just build a dedicated team. But it's just, this is the thing of being a bit too cautious of, you know, how do we just suddenly expand and have 15 people, because M&A is a different beast. You do need to have a large team who's seen nuanced issues, 15-year-old companies. But yeah, it sounds great to have a capital markets team, but who knows, maybe in 6 months I'll suddenly realize, yeah, let's do it if I meet the right partner. But
Avnish told us on the barbershop that, Shantanu, do you know that when the company goes public, all SHAs are thrown in the dustbin?
Yeah.
They don't exist anymore. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
Like, that's a great reason to do it. All the work Archana has done.
Like, we know MIS. We don't have to share. Get on investor cards.
Well, there's no like.
Yeah. Because now it's public markets.
It's all gone on the window.
Everything goes. Wow.
And another thing, like people have told me, is which I've thought is, right now your board is like a collection of all your qualifying investors or people who have a certain amount of stake.
Yes.
And that's not the way a board should be.
No.
board should not be a motley crew of your investors representing their own interests.
Yeah, the your board independent should, director. Someone's actually thinking of the company fiduciary obligation.
The board of the company is to think company first. All the investors naturally will think investor first. Yeah. So a lot of this now, are you preparing for an IPO? I'm sure. Would you have to think about it? Would you?
I mean, in the next couple of years for sure. And as you rightly mentioned, I think when you're a privately held company, a lot of things that we do is not going to fly with the market regulator, right? I mean, like recently, the regulator has come out with something it's called like the KPIs. So, you know, with our investors, we kind of share a huge amount of information on a month-on-month basis to how do you track your business. The regulator is saying, if you're sharing all these things to these set of investors, anytime 3 years prior to you taking the company public, all those KPIs you need to share with the public market investors as well. Now, imagine a situation when I'm preparing for an IPO, and probably, let's say, 2 years down the line, I have to start shutting down all that supply of information to my private equity investors from today. So it's a long lead process, and you need to start preparing small little things, you know, who has to be on the board, how many of them has to be independent, what kind of rights would they have. The public market, you know, of course, there is no SHA, but the public market regulations are far more complicated than it is like in a private company, and then the quarterly reserves, the whole limited review process. So you need to prepare the entire organization in a very, very different manner. So on one side, you have a limited set of investors governing with all this SHA and the liability on you. But the moment you become a public market investor, then you're talking about like thousands of investors who are questioning you on a quarterly basis about your performance. And then everybody in the firm is looking at the ticker on a day-to-day basis to what's happening with your stock price, right? Yeah. So so it's just a tough one. But I think, you know, a lot of this has got to do with how you think about preparing yourself over a period of time. It's not, I see a lot of young companies, this whole euphoria about taking the company public. With due respect, without understanding the fact that it's a lot more responsibility of managing a public company. Private companies are, you know, with all the pain that we're talking about from the investors, believe you me, they're angel as compared to when you go in the public markets and start dealing with, with, you know, a very, very different set of investors altogether. They're going to punish you hard. They're going to be asking you some very, very tough questions, not going to be patient about it. You know, they live by the quarter because that's the nature of public market transactions, right? Because they have to do a mark to market on a daily basis. So they're going to live with every quarter, whatever you promise, you don't deliver next quarter, and the stock tanks, right? So you have to be very, very sure. Have you reached that inflection point where if you give a guidance to investors saying, I'm going to grow at 40% next year, you better hit that number. You can't even be 39%. You're not good at 39%. You have to be at 41% or 40 to ensure these investors kind of, you know, value you for whatever you've told them. So a lot of that process, that governance, how you think about the management team, how do you think about the KPIs, has to be broken down into smaller pieces to ensure that you're hitting those numbers on a quarter-on-quarter basis, and only then take the company public. And we've seen some, this is unfortunate, I don't want to name companies, which has been like a very yo-yo kind of a, you know, public life. And that's a tough one for the founder as well, right? Because he's put his good 10, 15 years already, and every day he's seeing that stock going, you know, 10% up and 10% down, and everybody's asking him the question, what's happening in the company, right?
Can I give you my personal opinion? I think we are waiting too long to take companies public.
Yeah.
I think, and I spoke to Rohit Bansal, in fact, at Snapdeal and Titan. And he said ki, he was ganne ka juice pura nichod ke agar tum le jate ho company ko public mein. Because he's like, you're optimizing for returns to your private investors. You're totally optimizing ki, boss, this was where you entered. This is my listing price. You're optimizing for this. But yahan pe bhi to buyer hai. The buyer here, you want to carry them now for the next 10 years.
Yeah, it's someone, till then.
So from here, you can't like do this. Yeah. Right? From here, you just keep going up. And frankly, I think of my space, consumer. You think of my investors, Colgate, for example, who were one of the very few MNCs who did not leave India in the George Fernandez era when everyone had to leave. Mm-hmm. Colgate listed in India, had a local cup, and then kind of There are stories of people coming into Colgate shareholder meetings and like normal middle class Indian family saying, "Mere beti ki shaadi hui because of Colgate shares." Mm, wow. And because, you know, they held on to it and then they rallied up. And Mr. Dhirubhai Ambani, of course, is a legendary story of creating value. But I think new age companies, the idea is, objective function is to give returns to your private investors, which is great. But then the person who's buying also has to have a journey with you. And for a brand, like for Colgate to do that was value creating for Colgate, the brand, for users who are using their oral care products. I feel if we go public, I'm kind of becoming a lot more sure about this. If we go public, we want to go public early. Yeah. Of course, we will need good anchor mutual fund investors and so on. So get them, it has to be sizable. Sure. But it can't be so late stage that the retail, because then if they don't have a good time, then it'll affect my brand very badly. Yeah. Hey, look at Gillette, right? Yeah. What a brilliant story, Asian Paints. Such, and when that story goes on for decades, yeah, then those brands create tremendous consumer love also, in addition to, of course, investor love. So I think that's one thing that if you do have a capital markets team, I think my...
Multiple clients just in this...
from state to a public...
Fund, yeah, actually, yeah, that'd be a great line on our website. Right now, we're saying from 1 million to 1 billion financings. Should just say...
Yeah.
Right after.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe 1 billion financing is way too big for public also. So it's fine. 1 million to 1 billion is actually fine. But frankly, I think I would love... It is needed. I think it is, like, companies like us are clueless, man. We're clueless. Like, how, like, what? Some of these things we'll learn. We'll talk to, like, a few bankers. We'll talk to a few
founders. Right, or small things. Like, how do you prepare for an IPO itself? Like, who do you start and when do you start engaging advisors? Just figuring out your cap table. How do you list if each per share price itself is that?
Someone else told me, you know, I was like, if you go public, then, you know, that person is like, you know, you're a... Of course, there's the quarter on quarter pressure to, like, guidance and hitting that guidance. And, like, in a, people don't realize in a private round, your price is set once.
Yeah.
And then it's not set again till the next round, right? Price. In public markets, your price is set every day. Yeah. Every transaction, like, if I sell one share to you, that defines the value of the whole company, right? Yeah. So, the responsibility is on the promoter. So, promoters have to stay locked in for, like,
right. That's why you don't have that years. Contractual one like you do with your investors now, but you are actually truly locked in.
You're locked in. And I was talking to a few friends the other day and they were like, boss, if you sell even a small percentage of it, people feel, oh, he knows something about the company.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was just about to touch upon that topic, right? I mean, the public scrutiny on you is so high that every conduct of yours, and not just yours, by the way, the entire senior management team, right? How are they conducting themselves, both in the public and in private? It's just so open for scrutiny that you have to be very, very sure that any of these things, the slightest of things, because media is, of course, become very powerful, will have a very immediate impact on your stock. There is no thing about, like, okay, I'll go and talk to my private investor, explain to them this is probably, like, just a one blip and things going to all cool down. Every day, you will be constantly looking at that barometer and say, oh, shit, I mean, what did I do to get punished so hard? But look at the other side. I mean, these are all investors which have got money from a very different set of investors, right? Yeah. Who are benchmarking their mutual fund returns on a quarter-on-quarter basis. So they don't really care about what your long-term growth story is or what you're trying to build and change, right? All they care about is how much money that they're going to make over the next maybe 12 months or 24 months time frame.
Yeah.
So their return appetite is very different. Their patience is also fairly limited. But at the same time, there's a very, very deep pool of capital. So the good thing about the public market is that unlike private, where there are probably, let's say, 100 investors, you're talking about at least, if not more, 100x more deeper capital markets pool. So you're right. Once you go public, then if you continue to do well, there's absolutely no dearth of capital. You'll be surprised to know that, Shantanu, in a single day, like today you launched the transaction after your listed company, in less than 1 week, you can get what is called like a QIP, a qualified institutional placement, with no massive diligence, blah, blah, blah. You can raise about $1 billion. And there are companies, who have raised anywhere between $3 to $4 billion, like even before the market starts, and they open a transaction, which is called a QIP, which is qualified institutional placements. And you will see a $3 to $4 billion, but probably $10 billion bid will come in. They will kind of do the allocation and $2 to $3 billion will come to the company. So that is how deep the capital markets pool in this country is, because the LIC, the insurance companies, the mutual funds, the FIs, right? All of that pool of capital, they can't invest into private companies, because as part of their charter, they have to necessarily only invest into liquid assets. Now that completely debars them from investing, even if they like to, let's say, invest into a very large, but a private company, unfortunately, they can't invest into those companies. And this is where there's something called a scarcity premium that comes in. So let's assume there are only two or three consumer tech companies like yourself getting listed. Apart from your own story and stuff like that, you say, hey, you know what? If I have to play a consumer tech story in India as a large mutual fund, where do I invest? So there are only two companies available. I need to do some allocation into these companies, irrespective of whether, you know, they are the best within that segment or not. But these are only two companies available. So you have a scarcity premium attached to it on top of it.
So you're saying there are deep markets.
Very, very deep markets.
And you also have now a large number of private companies that are venture funded.
Yes.
For whom exits have to happen for your investors.
Absolutely.
And so IPO is not really a choice anymore.
So the only two things, right? I mean, see, the beauty that has happened over the last 10 to 15 years in India, there was only one way that the businesses were getting built, which is you need to have a surname in this country.
Yeah.
They would never sell the company. So M&A used to be very far and few. The only thing, once in about 5 or 10 years, one of these large, corporate houses would come and raise money from the public markets, right? And that's about it. Outside of that, there was no such thing about, you know, a lot of M&A or private equity and stuff like that. Now, suddenly with this private pool of money coming in, every company yesterday, like whether it's your company or Mintify as well, significant part of our shareholding is controlled by these private equity investors.
Yeah.
So they need to find exit, whether it's 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, they need to find an exit that can happen through an M&A or that can happen through a public market transaction.
Yeah.
So all this pool of capital, whatever India has seen, about $40-50 billion of private money coming in into this country, which cumulative today is about $100+ billion in terms of whatever the valuation is. Now, this money has to necessarily be returned to these investors in some shape and form, whether it is M&A, whether it is secondary transaction, one private equity investor buying from the other, or they all going and taking the company public, where the mutual fund investors. So, you know, you're kind of recycling the whole capital, which is different set of investors coming at different point in time. And therefore, you have a lot more opportunity now available in this country where you can do all kind of transactions possible, for any company, right? The mid-sized company can do a transaction, a large company can do a transaction. So I don't know if you've been tracking, there's something called an SME exchange in this country, where a company with less than 100 crore turnover can go public.
Yeah.
This is how typically the capital market evolution takes place. Right? There will always be those bull and the bear market. You will have those excesses getting created where some people will try in the short term, do some funny things around, you know, getting a quick buck by listing in some exchanges which are somewhat less regulated. They're not regulated, but they're somewhat less regulated. But think about it in a very different context, right? There will be a lot of companies which may not qualify for getting listed in the main board. And unfortunately, these are also businesses, with due respect, will not get qualified for getting investments from a private equity funds.
Yeah.
Because these are not your traditional consumer tech, internet, fintech companies, and so they could be hardcore manufacturing.
Correct.
Nobody wants to fund them, right? Now, where did the poor guy actually gets the capital from? And this is where the only option available for them, whether good, bad, ugly, is to go to the public market route.
Yeah.
Some of these will be reasonably good companies, may not be so well governed. And that's where, you know, depending upon how committed the founder is, where is he really seeing, the valuation and stuff like that, can either build a very large company and then migrate to the main board, or unfortunately, may just take away some of the investors' money and vanish. So depending upon, you know, who's running the company, and that's where the governance processes and becomes very, very important. It's true that the market is very hot at this point in time, and there are a lot of companies, you don't even think about it. You know, how come such a small company is getting subscribed some 100x or 200x, and what is the real story behind it? But fundamentally, the key thing to this whole thing is the capital formation has to happen, right? If the capital formation doesn't take place, how will businesses get created? We are all going to be concentrated towards only looking at businesses which are known to the private equity universe, which is your typical, you know, internet or tech-led businesses. Yeah. The real capital formation, you know, which is where our Honorable Minister recently commented as well. Now, those businesses are hard to build, and those businesses are extremely, local in nature. These are not businesses where you can look at a US replica and say, okay, can we build a similar business in India too, right?
Okay.
So you're solving for a local problem. You're solving for something which is extremely hard to build. You've got a lot of regulatory frictions around it, the land, the permissions and stuff like that. So while dealing with all of those things, imagine that particular SME having to need access to capital. Forget about debt, right? I mean, the first thing is equity, because only if you get equity will you get debt.
Yeah.
So it's chicken and egg for him that even if he can get access to debt, and government has done a lot of work around how do you make debt accessible to these guys, but it's only when you have the equity capital.
Yeah.
And this is where these people will get attracted to some of these not so regulated markets. It is regulated, but not so well regulated. But good companies will last, and unfortunately, some of the bad ones won't.
Yeah. I do feel like, you know, this is just the start of the wave of IPOs.
Yeah.
And I think, for example, a lot of the wave one IPOs was a lot of narrative building. You know, it's a lot of optimism and narrative, and the belief was the numbers will follow. In some cases, they did. In some cases, they had to play out. Wave two, slightly better companies. There was like a Swiggy, for example. Zomato's gotten this kind of value.
Yeah.
You're getting the same kind of asset, but at, you know, this kind of discount, and then the numbers will follow. That better. But wave three, like a lot of these companies have now become a lot more kind of robust in their financials. Yes.
Yeah.
And from small to big, it's not just like, not just Flipkart and some of these big ones. Yeah. Also like smaller companies which are under a billion are also become a lot more robust. And I personally feel like it's a very good thing for the country that people, it shows A, skin in the game for promoters for the longest time. B, it shows depth of capital markets and for the future, and I think larger allocation to newer age businesses. And see, I think it will attract private capital a lot more also. So the moment you have a lot more IPOs.
And the fourth one, it's also actually creates a great brand value, by the way. And especially for businesses like yours and ours, where it's tough to, and how much money would you spend? Believe you me, if you start doing well on the capital market side, there is a good amount of goodwill that gets created.
Yes.
Because of the fact that these investors just generally will feel better, and that whole word of mouth about this is a great company, well-governed company, that essentially will also reflect into the way your overall, you know, organization is doing.
Yeah.
The kind of talent that you can hire, the kind of, you know, everything just like kind of falls, tuck, 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 everything falls in place, right?
So clearly your capital markets practices.
just sold an idea to you.
Huh? Now for just the entire team to show up at the
But Arjun, how's the journey been like for you, you know, especially with RL over the last 10 years now?
10 years, yeah.
You are a founder in your own right, right? I think a service business, building out a partnership. It's not a private limited company. Dude, are law firms...
No, it's all like it is partnerships because... That you keep upstreaming profits every
even
year.
Sam, like Cam, all these guys are all partnerships?
Yeah, it's all partnerships because that's the most efficient way to take out. It's not like a company where you're doing this for the long run and sell shares eventually to someone. You actually do, unlike a company where you don't take out profits and you put it back and then you sell shares, this is ultimately just taking out the profits that you made for that year based on your billing. Yeah. So it makes sense to have a partnership.
In consulting, for example, there are two models, right? There is like a partnership model. McKinsey is a partnership model. And never planned on becoming private limited. There were talks of listing McKinsey at one time, but the thinking was so amazing. The thinking was that if we take the company public today, no future partner will ever be incentivized enough. And all current partners will make the killing, but it's a one time. It's like we'll kill the golden goose, right? On the other hand, there are companies like ENY and some of these larger ones, which are more advisory in nature, which are publicly listed companies. So I think in the service world also, I think there are options. But you're a partnership.
Law firms are, and we are a partnership.
Is there any exception to this in India or globally?
There are sole proprietors. We were a sole proprietorship. As in Rajaram Legal, we had a pseudo-equity structure, but it was just me, right, as Rajaram Legal. And a sole proprietorship, I think Nishit Desai would be a... Sole proprietorship, like, and you have one person running it, or solo practitioners as well. They start out as one person and then keep growing, but it's that one person who's generating and doing everything. And then, you know, that's when I think you start seeing folks as just dispensable resources. So then there's different firm models, but predominantly law firms are as partnerships.
Yeah. And there's no exception to this, which are like private limited law firms.
No, not that I've seen in India at least.
Mm. Yeah. And how true is the whole suits thing? Like, do you... divorce.
Absolutely not. It's far from it. In fact, once, in fact, Sarthak, I think, you know Sarthak, right now at SoftBank, but he had joined one of the negotiation calls early. We go back from Matrix days. He was there and he was like excited to join the first negotiation, and he was messaging me saying, this is not at all like Suits. We were discussing some SHA technical clause. He's like, is this what all negotiations are like? So yeah, there are no Suit moments at all. Even the law firm drama, there's nothing that exciting. And
I think it's because of the nature of the work. I'm assuming like if this is more...
Yeah, maybe if it's litigation, then there could be some cooler things that you're arguing in court. But with transaction and with corporate law, as in, I find it exciting, all the behind the scenes and all the drama that happens on the day of signing. And but I don't see anything being like TV drama worthy.
I want my name on the wall.
What's the name on the wall thing? Like now you can't do that with River Law. Cool.
Interesting. No, actually, even thinking along that if it was Rajam, and even if we wanted to keep adding folks, it'll just too much. Let's just rebrand to something cool that just sticks now.
Have you enjoyed the journey of building? How big is the law firm now? How big is
30 of us now with 5 partners?
Wow.
I've enjoyed it. It's just, I didn't think it's something I was cut out for. But it has, I think, with everything, I've changed a lot as a person. It's still a long work in progress, but it does teach you phenomenal skills, right? Like you can face a lot of fear and you just have to somehow push it to the background and then just deal with things. Especially 2023 when like we're a transaction-focused firm and hardly any deals were happening. So it's a scary time to just stay in there, figure things out. How do you keep a team motivated? How do you deal with conflict with, like, interpersonal, not conflict exactly, but people are complex and grow at different levels. But it's...
And you see AI disrupting your
in a great way, because it gives you great answers. We're like signing up with more platforms now, but we just keep experimenting with just ChatGPT. You'd be surprised.
Amazing, no?
It's just mind-blowing. It's like working with the great, I don't want any of the senior associates at the firm to hear it, but it's like a great resource.
Yeah.
If you just want a quick question, and I sometimes just play with it that if, you know, someone's given me an answer on what a clause is, but I've sent it a ChatGPT to say, what's a simple way of articulating this? And it's brilliant.
Yeah, exactly.
It's in 2 sentences, a really complex clause. It's great.
And also, like, do you use,
I suppose,
like, in, we have started using it a lot more individually. Also, like, there are some people who've taught us how to use it a lot more. I was like closing the loop, putting in attachments. For example, if I'm preparing for a podcast, I'll do the research, and then the final podcast goes out. I send the link back. Hey, this is the final podcast. Thanks for the prep. Here are 3-4 things you missed out or whatever. And
yeah, the training part of it is just insane.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I feel like law firms can just actually become more efficient with billing as well. You don't need tennis. I think a lot of firms have just switched to using just AI for diligences. But the crucial part is that's a problem with DDs. Like you've seen it.
Yeah.
Who wants that 200-page report that you need someone to tell you you're in one page what the key issues are, or there's an issue, but what the implications are. So I think from a senior partner standpoint, there's a lot more security to understand Indian nuances. How can this play out for a regulated sector? There's a lot of analysis, which is still, I'd say that gap is still there, because someone may have flagged something innocuous, right? Like those, there are unlimited forms that you have to file when you issue shares, right? And many companies will miss. But how do you know which form actually plays an impact in an M&A deal, that the deal can't go forward because this particular file form didn't get filed? That only someone with experience. So for now, it seems okay. But I feel even that in like a year can catch up and say what the implications are. Thankfully, India changes regulations every 6 months. And then it's, you know, always reading what the regulator's thinking of before it's in fine print. As we've seen.
The research bit is fairly extensive in your kind of a profession, right? And to have something which is
in your pocket,
constantly changing, you know, I mean, how do you keep track of all of this? And now suddenly you're going for a client meeting, you know exactly, okay, can I get a response for it? And very quickly you can exactly get to, you know, what is exactly happening, what's the implication around it.
Right, because when we did the diligence at Series D, the regulations changed completely.
Absolutely, yes.
And then the different layers, right? Yeah. So then you'll keep moving. I was thinking, oh, we just have to do a top-up diligence. Sure, we'll get it done. And Anup said 10 days. I was like, sure. And then realized, oh, no, why did I go up to 10 days?
Wow. That's incredible. And going forward, do you see, like, I do want to talk about, actually, we've seen over the last 3-4 years, every now and then there are bad actors.
Yeah.
In the ecosystem, and it's very, it regresses the entire ecosystem back. like Blue Smart, for example, what's happening there is very painful to watch. I don't know what your views are on this. Yeah. They were in this building, by the way. Yeah. Blue Smart office was like on 7th floor? 6th floor? 6th floor? 1 floor above us.
Yeah. It's unfortunate.
I love that product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even today.
Yeah.
Today morning.
Yeah, I remember a post of yours as well, how like seamless it's been. Very good quality cars. It was itself. Like a lot of small things that made the whole customer experience.
Outstanding. It was outstanding. Like I sometimes wonder that, okay, fine, you needed money. I think that that was one of the few products where they actually could have charged a premium.
Yeah.
And the business model would have worked. And maybe people are saying electric vehicle asset life is a lot shorter.
Mm.
Sure, whatever. But okay, fine, you want to own the assets, charge 2x. There would have still been a market. It may have been a smaller market, but the market would have been there. And yeah, having a public company, borrowing money there, buying the assets, leasing it here, and then taking the extra money, buying houses. And it's just now become a, like the moment something, there's a situation.
The entire ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah. Memes have started coming about. I'm like, oh God, if this has now reached the viral meme orbit, then I think it's very mainstream now.
Well, that's exactly what happened, Shantanu. Like any, when we talk about lawyers being, you know, whatever, sorry, but painful, fundamentally, the client is telling him, you know what, in this particular case, I've actually gone through all these issues, right? Now, the largest ed tech company, we know what has happened, right?
What,
now,
like,
now, all of those things essentially means that the entire ecosystem is getting painted with the same brush and saying, hey, you know what, we need to be a lot more careful because somebody is sitting out there in the U.S. Imagine a large private equity fund sitting in the U.S. is saying, hey, you know what, we're seeing a lot of this happening in India. Can you please up the whole diligence process? And then what do you do, right? Whatever may be the case and whatever, you know, good that you have done so far, suddenly everything starts getting questioned. And that's where you are dragging the whole process. On one side, you have to focus on building the business. You're trying your best to kind of ensure that the numbers are, because when you're in the thick of transactions, you've also committed a particular number to your investors that, that you want to deliver. But on the other side, you can only focus so much on the business when there is transaction on the hook. And these are, you know, unfortunate bits in situations like this. If companies go down because of genuine, you know, operational issues or because whatever the fundamentals didn't stack up, that's fine.
Yeah.
But if company goes down because of governance issue, it impacts the entire ecosystem.
And this isn't, like, I sometimes feel like of course, the governance issue, but is this theft?
Yeah, it is.
Definitely. And that's why there's so much sensitivity, related party transactions. So doing diligence is great. So diligence taking longer is, in fact, a great way of doing a deal, right? Because you want to probe harder, you should deep dive because investors ultimately are relying on information that founders giving, and diligence is one time with external advisors to poke and figure out what's happening. So diligence is good, but what's happening is that, and law firms are being told, right? How do we fix this? This is the conversation everywhere. How do we fix this? How do we make it more robust? But to be really candid, having it more robust in an agreement isn't going to solve for this, right? What's the point of having unwind situations? Like saying when a company is on the brink of shutting down, to say, I'm going to take the shares and do what? Yeah. At what stage will you then get a CEO? It's gone on too far. Now you're adding clauses and you're making it scarier and scarier for a founder to take that leap of faith. Yes, on one hand, fraud, all of that, no one wants to legislate. But then people want to expand the definition of cause to make it like 15 different things to say all of this creates governance issues. And then it can't be so like a hair trigger event that a founder is asked to lose all his shares, right? Which is why it's taking much longer. And at what point you keep saying, like, you've built a company for 8 years, and at what point you keep saying you have to earn your shares, you have to earn your shares. What are the triggers to lose your shares? Fraud, yes, no one wants to negotiate that. But beyond the point, if you always tell a founder, no matter what you do, and even if you build the company to this great value, it always has to be like a very amicable way, reaching a discussion, reaching a solution. How are you solving for a situation of 3 founders? And then, you know, they're very controversial conversations on what if one co-founder is just not pulling their weight at that stage. It's a very complicated conversation to say he's built and he's given that value and you're asking him to let go, but you also want to take his shares after like 7 years of taking very low salary. Those are really tough conversations to have. And that's where it's not an easy answer. And then you can't have it in an agreement upfront. Those don't happen every day, thankfully, that there's one person not pulling their weight. And you can't, for that reason, just put it across the board that, anytime if you are let go of, we will take, or we'll buy you out at FMV, which is optically meant to sound fair, but FMV could be, 10 rupees a share if you just go by assets and liabilities. And if it's a younger loss-making company, in fact, FMV could be negative. So those kind of clauses get very controversial, and it's taking longer, spooking more founders out. They don't even know how to pick this up because no one wants to have a conversation with the investor. You're trying to raise money and you don't want to talk about, but if these adverse situations happen, but there's no perfect solution to it.
But why are founders like,
why would they go down this path?
Is it as simple as that?
Some just turn rogue in the
greed. System. This greed?
No, I don't think so. See, you have to also appreciate, Shantanu, a large part of the ecosystem that is currently building businesses, they all come from very humble middle-class background, right? They need capital to build a business. And whether we like it or not, but fact of the matter is you have to take that leap of faith to take the capital and go out and build a business, hoping that everything will be fine and we will not end up being in a tough situation.
Yeah.
Now, the investors are doing their bit to ensure that they protect their interests. The founders want money and they are kind of signing on something which sometimes they should not sign on something. But to me, I look at it a slightly more objective way to say that, hey, you know what, if everything goes well, nobody is going to go back and read that document.
Yeah.
If things don't go, you know, as you had planned for it, anyways, you can do whatever you like to. You're not getting your money back, right?
Where's
the money?
Where's the founder? Where's the money? Where are the shares?
Where's the money? Yes.
So it's just, and then, but people are still worried. Of course, you can't just look the other way and say, yeah, shit happened. So you're making that 200
And then I've had this conversation with some of my investors. I said, okay, if that be the case, then we should not have any agreement. We should all be on faith. I said, no, that's not what I meant. Please have the document. But I'm just saying that you're making it a little onerous. Can we try and, you know, simplify a bit? But see, they are doing their fiduciary job and ensuring that this gets covered. But yeah, a lot of times, and imagine when there are two or three founders and suddenly you're having these conversations between the founders and say, you can get kicked out if you don't do this and you can, your shares can be. So will your shares also be taken back? I'm like, okay, no, I don't know. The mine will be taken back. Yours can be taken back. Yeah. Right?
Wow. The dynamics with three founders or even two founders.
Complicated, no?
Complicated. And at what point do you, because you have to then give it to another CEO. Why would the investors get diluted? Why should this person benefit from someone else turning the company around? And that's why, like, I don't think founders, when they set it up, have that conversation between themselves. It's some investor who comes in and says, this is what happens. Yeah. But what happens? What's the arrangement they have between them? Because you've talked about all the aspects of the business, but not really, what if it doesn't work out? What if we're not able to run this? What's the right thing to do?
I also think that, for example, I also think with governance, right? I think a lot of times founders reach a point where they make like large judgment errors. I don't think anyone starts a business with the intent to be frauded.
Of course not. Nobody. Why would?
Yeah, it's more that pressure of suddenly now to.
Yeah. I don't like with Blue Smart. I don't know, but like in general, like the, like with Baiju's, for example.
Yeah, when you cook your.
Huh?
No. This is when you cook your books and then just dial it back.
No, a large part of, if you look at the cohort of people who are coming in building the startup, right? They're very well educated. They come from the best of premium institutions, the IITs and IIMs of the world. And they've already gone through a lot of those whole, you know, grind in their life to get to where they are, right? It's not easy to get to some of these premium institutions in this country. And then they were not going to start with the intent of saying, I'm going to take this somebody's $5 million and run away and settle down in Dubai or whatever, right? They all start with the right intent.
Surprised, actually. Correlation between education and value system is actually much lower than one might imagine.
Yeah.
Like, because it's inexcusable. Yeah. I try to rationalize it in my head a lot.
You wonder, right? Why would you burn your bridges for life over this?
Why would you steal from your own company? Like, why would you do that?
What have you set up? What have you achieved that much for?
And or you've recognized it's a burning home and you're just kind of, now you're like, boss, this is going to...
I think the latter is true. My sense is in this whole thing about not wanting to, you know, agree with what the reality is and pushing that can down the road. Ho jayega. And it doesn't happen. And then sometimes this whole thing becomes so big, it's on your face, right?
Yeah.
And that point is, oh shit, I mean, I'm the only one who know about it. So let me at least try and save my house. We'll figure out what happens later.
Yeah.
So whether it's investor pressure, whether it is his own, you know, mental framework at that point in time. But you're right. I think it's always the case when the things have gone a little out of his hand is when all of the juggleries start happening.
It's another practice for you then.
today we're going to be like a full service firm for Arshana.
Right, that's I know, like right? I'll go back law. Now for our partners and be like, guys, we have
bankruptcy, litigation.
So definitely capital markets, and the second is governance. No,
I mean, that's why there are full service firms that just do this, because there is a huge market for it. Right? This is where this thing about not able to, like finding the right partner to run with it. I have my own, like I do it because I love all the areas of work that we do. So estate governance, planning? It's like going back to what?
Estate planning.
Her friend does it. She was an office the other day. Shreya was an office the
other day. Friend. Oh yeah, because then.
Yeah. She's like, she was telling me stories. It was amazing. She's telling me, so she does estate planning. That's her, like tax and estate planning. So clearly she had like billionaire clients or whatever.
Yeah.
She's like, art is like this whole thing.
Yeah.
Like inheriting art and then buying art, and then someone is saying that the art is not real. It's some auction house and cross border law. Yeah. How, like, that's amazing, man. You found this really cool niche
to actually.
And she like she's totally killing it. Yeah, but I think for founders specifically, I think this governance coaching and making sure that you don't reach a point where the slope becomes now in too that slippery. Yeah, okay. Just like 2 months or like few quarters in advance, you fix.
It's less legal than it is more on financial irregularities, right? Like what are they reporting?
You're right.
It is a fascinating space, but once it actually goes completely in a different.
I don't think I don't know who.
It happens more for like investors, like their strategy. What happens in this situation? There's a lot of closed door conversations.
It's not a. What happens if this happens? It's a, let's make sure we
make sure it doesn't happen. And everyone's discussing it, but how do you actually, because that's why you put these safeguards, right? Who would be the advisor? So that your stat auditor, your internal auditor, you'll have finance committees, you'll have audit committees, but those committees are still vacant. These are all clauses in the agreement and it's not set up.
For example, I'll give you some few examples. For example, all founder reimbursements, compensation, anything that goes to a founder or a related bank account, there has to be a committee that does it.
Founders barely get their salary. It takes so long to negotiate to just a reasonable salary.
No, but if somebody in his mind has made up that he wants to cheat,
these things
I don't think these are very, very, very innocuous things that people, they can be much
like
larger.
And
you've seen, right? Some of the vendor payments, where the fraud happens, right?
No, of course, like you'll have some third party. Whatever.
Exactly.
But like, how do you know who's a legitimate vendor? Exactly. It could just be anyone on the front, right? So that, to actually figure out, even if you're on the, how would you know that it's not a legitimate vendor
payment? I mean, and you just can't do that through.
And that's why it says, if it's a related party, that's why it requires prior consent, because you can't be dealing with any related party, right? You can't actually set up a company and say the company is engaging this entity for services. But if you don't disclose it, you are wiping out money through that.
And a lot of times we make this as an India problem. I don't think this is an India problem, by the way. It's a global problem. I mean, in the US, people are no less.
Oh, for sure. US is even worse.
Yeah.
I think US is worse.
Yeah.
Definitely. I don't know. Have you read this book called The Money Trap?
No.
By Alok Sama. Oh, it's a fantastic read. Yeah. He speaks, he was the CFO at SoftBank. Ooh. Worked closely with Masa-san for a long time.
Oh. And all what he's seen is in the book.
Yeah, and he's written it brilliantly. It's a beautifully written book. He's a funny guy. He's come on the podcast.
Okay.
I don't know, man. Governance is a tricky one, because we always, and it's very hard. Like, someone's telling me, like, if you're 21 years old, from middle class India, study your way into an IIT, come out, and you suddenly have a great idea, and you raise $5 million.
Yeah.
People don't realize $5 million is like
shitloads of money.
Yeah. It's like 4,500 lakhs.
Yeah.
So much is like...
For someone who was thinking about like a 15 lakh per year job,
suddenly
has 4,500 lakhs in their bank account with very little oversight as to how they're spending it.
Yeah.
It's crazy what it does to someone.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It can be... So which is where coaching, maturity and some of that is... just learned, right? It's not something that you're born with, I think.
Yeah.
Amazing. Archana and Anoop, this has been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Just to kind of go deeper into into what it takes to actually, how you think about advising clients, how you think about the ecosystem, how deal making actually happens. And again, your perspectives are so cool, because, you know, like, totally different world. And I love when we are able to get like two very unique perspectives on the table, and what you have built, what you're continuing to build. I really hope like that you continue to grow and help founders like us.
Take the company public.
Yeah. Take the company. Yeah, yes. I think that's the one mandate from today that at least like the capital markets practice has to happen, right?
Do estate planning properly.
Yeah. They're linked to each other, right?
There you go.
Take the company public, then
and
the
then
estate
planning. Or even beforehand for all the secondaries.
Yeah, and tax and all that. Yeah, yeah. I agree. I think we
have idea.
Clearly, Anup and I are like, Anup is like, mere ko ye bhi chahiye hoga, aur phir ye bhi chahiye hoga, and I don't want to go anywhere.
I've got two boys, so start planning for it now.
His own personal Mintify situation. No, but it's been such a pleasure. And, I really, really hope that people take away from this is it's super important to understand the nuance of the deal or to understand the nuance of a definitive document or what agendas could look like and how you have to navigate it. I think that's the most important thing. Otherwise, with our deals also,
it can just go on 30 issues. It can go on endlessly. Yeah.
So to get it done on time, win-win, commercial interests, big picture, and just kind of move forward, focus on the business. But amazing, and wish everyone at Riverlaw the very, very best.
Thank you.
And Anup, I think thanks so much for making your debut on the Barbershop with podcast. I'm so glad that you chose us to do it.
Thank you for having us.
I think we should do a full pod on Mintify as a business. It sounds super exciting.
Thank you.
And would love to learn more. I think
we'd love to do it. Yeah, absolutely.
So much more. I think a lot of our audience is also very fintech focused.
Okay.
They love whenever we've gotten folks from fintech, and so would love to do this. Thank you so much for coming.